We talk of theaters of war, the Pacific Theater or the European Theater in World War II, almost as if it were a place of entertainment. In July 1861, spectators gathered on the hills on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. to watch the first Battle of Bull Run. This past July, the New York Times reported that Israelis were watching the IDF drop bombs on Gaza. Throughout history, artists depicted war as a glorious activity, at least until Goya's series of etchings called The Disasters of War and his great painting, The Third of May, 1808. How can something awful be the subject of great art and that kind of fascination? Ian Baruma looks at this and a thorny set of related questions in his latest book, Theater of Cruelty, Art, Film, and the Shadows of War. It's published by the New York Review of Books, and I'm very pleased it brings Ian Baruma back to our show today. And you've been coming on the show for almost 30 years now, as long as I've been here. There have been many paintings, books, plays, and movies about the horrors of war since the early 19th century. Was Goya the first to do that?
No, I'm sure he wasn't, because if you look at even very ancient Tibetan Buddhist art, you see the horrors of that human beings can inflict on one another. So I think it's been a perennial theme.
Why do you think the word theater is used? It's the seventh definition in the American Heritage Dictionary.
Why do I think theater is
yeah,
used?
I mean, I know it comes out of Greek and Latin, meaning to watch and to view.
I think we tend to want to enact things that we're frightened of, including death, violence, and so on. To see it on stage, to play it out, is our violent impulses, our fears, and so on, is a way to deal with that kind of fear.
The New York Review of Books quotes you as saying that you're fascinated by what makes the human species behave atrociously. Is what makes us as a species, as a group, behave atrociously different from what makes us do those kinds of things as individuals?
Well, I think one difference between human beings and other animals, and I'm not an expert on apes and so on, so I might be generalizing too much, but is that animals don't tend to commit acts of violence out of sheer malice.
Well, I've seen cats torment their prey.
So it seems. We don't really know what goes on in the heads of these cats, whether they're actually deliberately tormenting them out of malice or whether it's something more playful, I don't know. But I think that human beings are particularly nasty in that way, and we want to humiliate our victims and so on in a way that animals tend not to.
As we are seeing right now from ISIS.
As we're seeing all over the world, I'm afraid, yeah.
You have quoted the Belgian-Australian writer Simon Leys on A Human Desire to Destroy. The quote is, "The need to bring down to our own wretched level, to deface, to deride and debunk any splendor that is towering above us is probably the saddest urge of human nature." Now, he was writing about the desire to destroy objects of beauty. Are your concerns more in the realm of ethics?
I think so. Why do people behave atrociously? I think it's evil in the sense of doing something out of pure malice, I think, is relatively rare. I think most people convince themselves or are convinced by authorities that what they're doing is somehow in a noble cause. You know, the famous speech by Heinrich Himmler to SS men in Posen, when he was saying that this was, they had to be quiet about what was essentially a noble cause, that is, extermination of the Jews.
And kamikaze pilots got the same kinds of speeches before they went out.
Well, kamikaze pilots are a more complicated issue because they were actually the elite of Japanese universities, often students who'd studied humanities, European literature, and so on. They were thought to be more expendable than those who did science. And they were idealists of a kind you find amongst young people everywhere, and thought that the war could no longer be won, but that this sort of act of supreme sacrifice would somehow redeem the nation.
Why do you think that movies in particular about war and violence are so popular? And we even have these video games in which we're not just witnessing the acts of cruelty. We actually have to be cruel to survive.
Again, I think for the same reasons that Elizabethan theatre is blood-soaked, including Shakespeare, of course, in that it's we have violent impulses. We're also afraid of these impulses, and acting them out is a way to kind of ritualize what in real life would be very dangerous.
Is your essay, A Japanese Tragedy, the only one that deals with an audience's response?
Remind me what the what the audience was I had in mind.
You give us a sense that the Japanese react differently to awful events or great loss, perhaps because of their culture.
I hope I didn't say that, because I don't think that they react differently.
Well, many people have wondered how the Japanese and the Germans could have committed so many atrocities during World War II, despite their highly refined cultural history.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I think, yes.
And then even recently, the Japanese prime minister praised World War II war criminals, despite the fact that everybody else in the world thought that was, insensitive?
That's very much a political agenda of the prime minister and fellow nationalists, which has less to do with actually praising war criminals than it has to do with the Japanese pacifist constitution written by Americans, which he wants to overturn, and so on and so forth. I'm not so sure he praised war criminals, is that he feels that Japanese politicians ought to be able to worship at a shrine where their souls, the souls of all those who died for the emperor since the last century, are enshrined.
Well, in that article, that essay, you described taking a tour among Japanese islands in fog, where the tour guide pointed out everything despite the fog making it all invisible.
Yes, that was one of my first experiences in Japan in 1974, and I was very puzzled because we went out to this beauty spot in a boat, and we couldn't see any of the beauties, but there was still this guide who was pointing out the beauties, and people were craning their necks as though it was there. And I was puzzled, and I thought perhaps they were being polite. Since these things were being pointed out, we might as well make an effort to try and look at them. Or there was a kind of make-believe, and that everybody knew was make-believe, and there was an agreement not to sort of to dispel the enchantment.
My guest is Ian Buruma, B-U-R-U-M-A. His latest book, Theater of Cruelty. You may recognize that phrase as coming from Antonin Artaud. We'll talk about him in a moment. The subtitle is Art, Film, and the Shadows of War. And these essays focus on Leni Riefenstahl, Werner Herzog, Clint Eastwood. I didn't understand why David Bowie, but David Bowie as well. Does it matter who the quality of the artist when we're talking about the fascination with violence and war?
For my purposes, yes, because there are certain preoccupations that tie many of the things I write about, I suppose. It's not that I'm wedded to certain subjects, but there are fascinations, preoccupations. And I tend to choose the subjects, especially when it's to do with art or film, among those people I find interesting or admire. So there, I think, yes, it does matter. And David Bowie, of course, was the most theatrical of rock stars, who shared my fascination in many ways for Weimar Germany and sex and violence.
Well, when we're talking about Leni Riefenstahl, we're talking about a very different kind of artist than Werner Herzog. She's implicated in the activities of the Nazi regime.
Yes.
But still makes great art. There was
Some
a lot of bad art.
Say,
well, there was a lot of bad art made at that time as well.
Yeah, a lot of very bad art. And one of the interesting things is that if you compare fascist art, and of course Nazism is a weird variation of fascism, but there's very little of any quality made in Nazi Germany, as some architecture maybe. Very, very little in literature and art that's any good. Unlike Italy, for example, where there's quite a lot of interesting stuff.
Well, there was a futurism, which was a major art movement.
Yes.
At a certain point, aligned itself with fascism.
Had at least had ideals that fascism could build on very easily. Lainey Riefenstahl and Herzog are interesting, and I juxtaposed them a bit by putting them in subsequent chapters, because Lainey Riefenstahl really did lend herself to Nazi propaganda and use German romanticism and the love of sort of sitting on misty alpine mountaintops and communing with nature and all these things that National Socialism used for its imagery.
Although she never made a film that glorified war.
No, but she glorified the Nazi Party.
Yeah, and she
certainly in the Triumph of the Will about the Nuremberg Rally, and it was very glorifying the race and the uniforms and all that. And so it was very disingenuous of her to say that she was just making a documentary. This was complete nonsense. It was a propaganda exercise of great technical accomplishment. I think she was a great technical movie maker. Whether she was a great artist, I'm not so convinced of that, whereas I think Herzog is. And Herzog is of that generation who was born at the end of the war, or in the war, that in a way had to create art, German art, from the same traditions, romanticism and so on and so forth, but without being tainted by what the Nazis made of it. And so they in some ways had to purify the German tradition of the abuse of the Third Reich.
A lot of artists have depicted art of war and power and cruelty in awful ways. Picasso did Guernica, for example. He also depicted tanks. We have people like George Grosz and Otto Dix making fun of the military and of abuses of power. Do they have any impact at all on the way things transpire?
I'm very skeptical about the idea that art would somehow make us better people. I don't think so. I don't think even the greatest art will lead to harmony and peace. But what it does do is that it gives us a deeper understanding of human nature, and so perhaps, and without understanding, we'd be completely brutal. So it might do some good, but. No, I don't think it has a huge political impact.
Bertolt Brecht is becoming popular again because people see similarities between what he was writing about then and what's going on now?
Yes, I think that's probably true. On the other hand, I think the reason that we still put Bertolt Brecht's best plays on is because he was a great lyricist, and it's not so much because of the message he had. I mean, I think messages are very quickly obsolete, and I think it's the same with great historical writing. We read Gibbon because he was a great writer, not so much because we want to find out about the decline of the Roman Empire.
The artists do have an impact at the time. Often they outrage the people who they are ridiculing, or in some cases, Richard Nixon asks Herblock for some of his political cartoons to hang him on the wall, even though Herblock's making fun of Nixon.
Yes, well, perhaps he was so vain that, as public figures often are, that even hostile caricatures are a sort of accolade to their fame.
Let's talk about Antonin Artaud, the man who actually gave us the phrase "the theater of cruelty." Are you influenced by his ideas?
No, not specifically. Not really, no.
He had a notion of cruelty that went beyond acts of emotional or physical violence. And interestingly, he played a rather cruel character in Call Dry as the Passion of Joan of Arc.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, but he was a bit like the surrealists in that sense, who were also fascinated by cruelty. You see it in Buñuel's films. And I think it's the cruelty of our unconscious, too, that they wanted to get at, and to impulses that are hidden or we suppress and come out in art.
Artaud wanted theater to engage people more actively, although he was dismissive of movies, despite the fact that he appeared in one of the greatest ones ever.
Yes, well, indeed.
In an essay on the film director Mike Lee, you mentioned Peter Brooks. Wasn't Brooks influenced by Artaud's theory?
I think he probably was, yes.
Was Mike Lee also influenced by Artaud's theories about theater and cruelty?
I I don't know. I would somehow doubt it. I think he's... I can't speak for him, but I don't know.
Now, I mentioned Goya earlier.
Mm-hmm.
These are great paintings, despite the fact that they have big messages in them, the etchings as well. Wouldn't we say that the concept of cruelty has changed a lot over the years since he painted the painting of the killings of innocent people?
I'm not so sure about that, whether what he understood by cruelty and what he was trying to express and by expressing it also, of course, protesting against is so very different from what we would think. I think he was outraged by things that we would still be outraged by.
Then we have other situations where many people were very angry with Joseph Conrad for the way he depicted what went on in colonial Africa, even though he gives us a rather horrifying picture of cruelty.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned him, because I think there is something that ties him together with Artaud and Buñuel and all the others, which is, I think, that the horror, the words that end the heart of darkness are often misunderstood. It's often understood as a kind of racist comment on the savagery of the dark continent and so on. I think what he meant is that the veneer of civilization, even in London at the time, was paper thin, and that the horror lies just underneath. And it was Kurtz was represented that, but not it was not sort of something that was unique to supposed savagery of the African. It was right there in the heart of Europe.
I always thought of Conrad as a critic of colonialism. He also wrote a book in which Europeans look really bad in Central America.
I think that's true. I mean, to the extent anybody in his time really thought that all forms of Western colonialism should come to an end, I'm not sure he really thought that, but I think he was certainly critical of the way it was carried out.
My guest is Ian Buruma, the author of many books, including The Wages of Guilt, Memories of War in Germany and Japan, The Missionary and the Libertine, Love and War in East and West. We can go on and on and on. He is the Paul W. Williams Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard, and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and a collection of his essays, these all were in the New York Review of
they
Books?
They were, yes.
Have just been published by the New York Review of Books under the title Theater of Cruelty, Art, Film, and the Shadows of War. In an essay on Werner Herzog, you discuss a distinction between accountant's truth and ecstatic truth.
These are his words.
Talks often about wanting to create some sense of ecstasy in his films.
And he doesn't really distinguish between his documentaries and his fictional films. I mean, he sees them all as part of the same project. And in order to express what he sees as the, sort of the deeper truth, the higher truth, the poetic truth, he's quite prepared to set things up in documentaries, make things up and so on, if they can do that, which is in his work, fascinating, but not entirely without problems.
And what kinds of problems do you see in a film like Grizzly Man?
Not so much Grizzly Man, but I think in other films.
Gary?
Well, I'll give you one example. He made a wonderful documentary about a particular place in Russia, which is a spot of pilgrimage. It's on a lake that's frozen, and according to legend, there's a hidden city under the lake, and people sit on the lake and try and peer at the city and pray. And there's an amazing image of all these people on the ice, sort of in deep prayer, trying to gaze at this legendary city, submerged city. And it later turned out, and he admits this very freely, that he just rounded up a bunch of local drunks and put them on the ice and told them to do this. Now, if you know it's set up, it doesn't perhaps doesn't have quite the power that it would have if you absolutely know that this is real. So there you sort of have it both ways.
But many artists have talked to me about something similar. Richard Avedon told me about his early photographs, which were documentary photographs, and he said he saw fascinating or a beautiful image of a boy on his father's shoulders, and he realized if he took the picture, it wouldn't work out because the sun was in the wrong place. So he asked the father to turn, and then he got this picture that became rather famous.
I think that's legitimate. Pretending you had an interview with Fidel Castro when you were nowhere near Fidel is something else, which another writer, whom I shan't mention now, but did.
In The Things They Carried, Tim O'Brien wrote, you can tell a true war story by the questions you ask. Somebody tells a story, let's say, and afterward you ask, is it true? And if the answer matters, you've got your answer.
Mm-hmm.
But don't some artists wanted to obscure things? I think the poet Frank O'Hara wrote, I write to make the world mysterious again.
I think that's fine, especially in poetry. I think in the end, it's a kind of agreement between the writer or the artist and the audience or the reader that they're not cheating you. And I think if you make it very clear that something is art, then there's no question of cheating.
Do you see cheating in the story of the afterlife of Anne Frank? Because she becomes an object of creation, doesn't she? Even though we get the diaries as she wrote them.
Well, it would be cheating if we made things up that she said or wrote if she didn't. But there are many ways to interpret, perhaps, what she wrote or thought. And there's legitimate reason to differ. And so all the arguments about Anne Frank, I think, have a lot to do with political and social positions that people take, and then she becomes a kind of
people treat her
excuse.
As property.
I'm sorry?
She's treated as property.
Very much so. She's also treated as a saint. And I was in Amsterdam a few weeks ago, and you see the crowds lining up around the house where she was hidden. And it is like a modern form of pilgrimage to worship a saint.
There are sad or strange parallels that you recount, like that of Hélène Baer and Philippe Julien. Can you tell us about them?
Yes.
And maybe perhaps read these little excerpts that you have them on the same day?
Well, she was a remarkable young woman from an assimilated, up-high bourgeois French-Jewish family, very musical, very sensitive and so on, kept a diary during the war, and then was taken away and died a horrible death in the camps, one of the camps. Philippe Julien was also French, more or less the same age, a little older, kept a diary at the same time in Paris, and I quote both diaries because they show how the same events, the same period in history can be experienced in such different ways, depending on who you are. And this is how it starts. Hélène Baer, 21, student of English literature at the Sorbonne. This is the first day I feel I'm really on holiday. The weather is glorious. Yesterday's storm has brought fresher air. The birds are twittering. It's a morning as in Paul Valéry. It's also the first day I'm going to wear the yellow star. Those are the two sides of how life is now. Youth, beauty, and freshness all contained in this limpid morning, barbarity and evil represented by this yellow star. Philippe Julien, 23, artist and aspiring man of letters. Read The Poor Folk and felt like a character out of Dostoevsky, just as I felt extremely Proustian 3 years ago. I always see myself through the coloured windows of my admiration. I'm afraid of having no more great works to immerse myself in. After Balzac, Proust, Dostoevsky, and the English, what is left for me? How ugly they are, those poor Jews, who wear, stuck to their clothes, that mean yellow star.
We don't have much time, but you write about a number of other people who both did admirable things and less than admirable things. You mentioned Christopher Hitchens, who you criticized for his position on the invasion of Iraq. Harry Kessler, one of the good people with some bad ideas. Should we be surprised?
We should not be surprised that good people have bad ideas. Sometimes more surprising is that very bad people sometimes have good ideas.
An example?
Oh, bad people have good ideas? I suppose Nixon goes to China is one example. But good people can have very bad ideas, and often for the best possible motives, because they think they're doing good, but by doing good, they're... I don't question the motives of many people during the Iraq War, such as Christopher Hitchens, who felt that that getting rid of a very bloody dictator was an absolutely fine and admirable thing to do. But, of course, as a result, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and lost their homes and so on.
I've always wondered about that justification, not because it's a bad idea, but because there are many bad dictators around the world. Why pick Saddam Hussein? Why not go after Mugabe or the leaders of North Korea? We can go on and on and on.
Well, their answer, which is not invalid, is that you can't go after all of them, and not being able to do all of them, why not do one of them?
And the one that's easiest to defeat.
Yes.
Ian Baruma's latest book is Theater of Cruelty, Art, Film, and the Shadows of War. It is published by New York Review Books, and I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.